You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at wearelibertarians.com.
Episode 13, The Paradox.
Welcome to The Paradox with your attending, Dr. Eric Larson. He is a practicing anesthesiologist and clinical assistant professor at Michigan State University College of Human Medicine. Listen in as he takes you behind the scenes of what practicing medicine in today's ever-changing world is like with another doctor. The Paradox is a fun and accidentally informative show for physicians, patients, or anyone who has ever found themselves in a waiting room.
Hello, this is your host, Dr. Eric Larson. Welcome back to The Paradox. If you're a first-time listener, thank you so much for stumbling upon the show or thanking your friend for directing you my way. I think you'll be in store for an interesting conversation today with an author and physician, John Hunt. The Paradox podcast is created by me in order to help physicians better understand what's going on in the trenches and to help those who are not physicians understand what physicians are doing within the trenches of medicine. Today, we're going to be talking about not the practice of medicine so much as we're going to be talking about the education of medicine, and specifically medical residency. For those of you who aren't not aware, once you finish medical school, which is generally after college, you complete some years of training in a specialty. So, for instance, mine was 4 years in anesthesiology, my wife did 3 years in pediatrics, and so whether you do primary care or you do specialty care, you're doing some level of training in your specific field. You may then do further training in a fellowship, in which case my guest did an additional 4 years learning a pediatric subspecialty. Our discussion today will be primarily based around the ACGME. And the ACGME is the American College of Graduate Medical Education. So as with everything in medicine, there are piles of acronyms everywhere simply because we don't want to say the American College of Graduate Medical Education very often. And the ACGME is a private organization that promulgates rules for how you train people in medical education. So you can't be an accredited program if you don't meet certain specifications. Now, obviously, every specialty has different requirements, and those are set forth by their specialty boards for the board certification process. But the ACGME sets rules in general for residents. So, for instance, they may have a rule saying that residents can only work a certain amount of hours per week, and they actually have such a rule. They may say every resident has to be trained by just physicians, which there is such a rule, although that has changed, and now physicians are no longer required to be trained just under physicians, which is an interesting development, which we can discuss at some other future time. So the AGME sets basic rules, but they, of course, as with any sort of organization that is setting rules, they're good at setting rules, and they set lots of them. And many of them are ones that are ridiculous or, you'd say, unnecessary. And so that's a lot of what the book goes into. It is a very funny book, and it's a very quick read, and I would highly recommend it to anybody who's interested in medicine and sort of bureaucracy. I mean, I guess who's interested in bureaucracy, but I guess how it relates to getting your job done. And if you're an academic, certainly you'll probably be able to understand a little bit this. And as someone who went through the medical education training process, you know, you don't see with the ACGME how it affects you. But when you think about it as the way you deal with in medicine with any sort of regulatory agency like the Joint Commission or JACO, which is obviously talked about in the book as well, you can understand that the same sort of principles apply with a different governing body that, and so you have to deal in a hospital system with not only the hospital rules as their accrediting organization, which is JACO, but you'd obviously have to deal with the education accreditation process. So you have sort of the double whammy as you get the boxes you have to check for both organizations with your job. And so our discussion focuses primarily on ACGME and hospital systems and sort of how medicine is changed, especially for an academic as Dr. Hunt, who is now retired. We will go into a little bit on his charity works that he has started in the country of Liberia. And we'll also discuss a little bit on medical tourism, and which I definitely will have to delve into further in a future episode. As always, I couldn't do this without your continued interest in sending me emails about show ideas. I appreciate that so much. Thank you so much for sharing the show. It's been far more popular than I had anticipated this early in the show, and I've learned a lot. I hope you have as well. I would recommend, if you're a first-time listener, to go back and look over the titles. You'll find a number of them, I think, that will be very interesting to you. We're going to talk about a number of episodes in this episode. We're specifically going to talk about population health, which is something I talked with Dr. Cod. We're going to discuss drug shortages, which are always a topic. And I discussed this with Dr. Marion Mass, which is one that I think is very critical and probably the one I've still learned the most in of any episode that I've done. We're also going to be discussing free market medicine, which I discussed with Dr. Keith Smith, who runs a surgery center, in the last episode, in episode 12. As always, you can go to patreon.com, that's patreon.com/theparadox, spelled the same as the show, and you can go there and become a patron supporter of the show. All the money raised there goes to the production and promotion of the show. It has helped me tremendously in not only providing encouragement, but has also allowed me to get a little bit better audio equipment and has made the show better. And so I think for that, I'd appreciate all the people who have given support. And so I'd encourage you to go there. There are also a couple of bonus things that you have access to. And so I expect to put more stuff there as I get more patrons. I'd encourage you to go to theparadox.com and you can find the show notes page. The show notes page for today is, of course, theparadox.com/013. And you can find links to the books and all the websites we talk about, and also be some backlinks to the previous interviews that I've done that relate to the show. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Dr. John Hunt, who's a pediatric allergy immunologist / pulmonary specialist, and we'll discuss his book, Assume the Physician. Enjoy. So this is Dr. Eric Larson. I'm here with author and fellow physician, Dr. John Hunt, who wrote the book, Assume the Physician, which is... I guess you'd say as funny as the title assumes. It was actually surprisingly fun read and quick, and I'd recommend it to anyone who has a spare couple of hours, or I guess it's longer than that, it's a couple hundred pages. But it was a real fun book about where it follows the history of Dr. Eddie Marcus, who's a first-year family practice resident. And I guess it highlights the sort of the inanity of the education process for residents, and does go into a little bit on the medical student side of things, at least into the selection process. So Dr. Hunt is currently on vacation, so I appreciate him taking some time out to talk to me today. So let's get a little background on you. So you are a pediatric pulmonologist, allergy immunologist. It's a lot of letters and specialties. Can you tell a little bit about your background and then what led you to write the book?
Sure. Yeah. After college, I took a year off to take all those pre-med courses, which I'd never taken in college because I was a geology major and enjoyed that kind of work. And went to medical school at GW in Washington. And the Navy paid for most of my way through that. So I paid them back by spending a few years in the lovely environs of San Diego for my pediatric residency. And then the also lovely but somewhat different environs of Iceland for the next 3 years.
Ooh, wow.
At that point, there was a NATO base there, and I was the pediatrician for NATO. And then back to been to Charlottesville, Virginia, UVA, where I did my fellowships, as you said, both in pulmonary and allergy immunology. And then I did an academic career. But concurrent with my academic career, I started some businesses in healthcare, device, pharmaceuticals, as well as a transportation company. And I started writing books. Actually, I started writing books in Iceland just because I had a little free time there as a general pediatrician, which may be uncommon, but at that point it was common, at least while you're in Iceland. And so I just got very entrepreneurial. And I was always kind of aware of the concerns in the healthcare system or the medical care system. But over time working in pharmaceuticals as well as devices and comparing that to the unregulated transportation business, relatively unregulated, saw a radical difference and a lot of concerns, which brought me in the end to resign my tenure at the University of Virginia and start working on the fight to bring a little bit of freedom into the medical system, a little bit of free markets, a little bit of pricing, a little bit of normalcy, which had totally been removed over the last couple of decades.
Right. And so I guess when you look at medicine, I think everyone talks about the free market aspects of medicine and how we're sort of a mixed industry, I guess you, if you want to call it an industry. But I think for people outside and probably even a lot of physicians inside, I think it's hard to, I guess it's hard to, unless you sit back and like look at it closely, to recognize how not a market situation is. I mean, obviously the third party payer system really distorts the market quite a bit. And you go into that quite a bit in your book. I mean, I want to see, so the book is, it's very funny and it shows sort of the I guess it exposes the bureaucracy and sort of the ridiculous nature of rules. And it doesn't have to be specifically, I guess, one of medicine. I mean, I think, you know, if it, I mentions in the front cover that it's written sort of along the same lines of Catch-22, which if you've never read Joseph Heller's book, it is fantastic. And it's one I'd highly recommend. But just sort of the circular nature of bureaucratic rules and sort of how they don't make any sense. And we have plenty of them in medicine, just like I think probably many industries that are governed largely or even partially by government. So you mentioned that you're in academia. You're not anymore, but you were for a while. So is that what brought you? There's certainly a lot of it about this, or the rules of residencies and things like that, which we'll go and get into a little bit. But is that sort of why you focus in the book so much on a first year family practice medicine resident to sort of go through all the ACGME and all those sorts of things?
Yeah. I mean, it was just, you know, I was immersed in academic life and, you know, the full triple threat of research, clinic and teaching, and kept on running into these ridiculous bureaucratic things that were promulgated by organizations such as the ACGME, which for all, you know, it seems to have complete compulsory power over universities these days. And yet, you know, why don't we just laugh at them with their silly lists of requirements for a training program? I don't see why we don't just thumb our nose and say, go away. Likewise, JACO, these, you know, there's some good stuff in JACO, no doubt, but they don't really need 1,000 pages to teach, you know, to make sure that you take the milk out of the fridge when it expires. It's so I was watching all the people change in academic medicine, where when I had joined the University of Virginia, it was very much Thomas Jefferson's university, where the faculty who provided the clinical work, the research and the teaching were really the key players, because we were providing the services to the people who needed us. And the division heads basically worked for the faculty, the department heads who, you know, titularly are above the division heads. The department heads worked for the division heads. The deans worked for the department head, and the president of the university worked for the deans. That's how it was when I got to UVA. But by the mid-2000s, roughly 2006, 2008, that kind of time frame, that structure had totally inverted, and it was a top-down command control economy and at the medical center. And we were all of a sudden just the servants to the particular whims of the next president of the university, who was pretty much following the whims of what was coming down from Washington, D.C. So things like, I'll say that things like, absolute prioritization above all else on certain little things that happen to be a little bit of a so, you know, a meme somewhere that pops up on somebody's screen and all of a sudden becomes, you know, the mandated primary thing that the whole university medical center must focus on. So I didn't like, I'm not sure that academics have fully realized that inversion has occurred, but it has occurred, not just at UVA, but everywhere. The faculty at most academic centers now are down at the bottom of the tree, as opposed to kind of the focus and getting the support needed to, you know, provide the services for the people who need us.
Right, and so, and I talked to Dr. Michelle Lacott a few episodes ago. We discussed the evolution of treating populations versus treating patients, and sort of this, and how it's it seems it's a strange concept, I guess, in some ways, to think that you're, when you're sitting in that room talking to a patient, you're actually treating a population. And but it does change your focus, right? When you're no longer you're treating sort of aggregate numbers as opposed to treating individual patients. And so it sounds like in many ways you've sort of seen the same sort of thing here with the universities. And I think probably the same goes for most large healthcare systems, which pretty much at this point are about every healthcare system, that they are focused more on meeting sort of criteria, or I wouldn't say it's algorithmic medicine necessarily, except, I mean, there is algorithmic medicine, but more that you have to meet certain dictates and things which rules which may or may not make any sense. I mean, sort of in the aggregate, they might make sense, but for specific patients or individuals, you say, well, that's actually the wrong treatment strategy. But we have to make sure we don't put urinary catheters in anybody because there's a risk of infection and there's, you know, government scoring and these sorts of things. And so a lot of these things seem to affect, I guess you'd say, the way that they get paid. And so that ultimately is what drives most of their decisions and rule promulgation. And so then you get to the point where you have today where the clinicians are less clinicians and maybe more, just workers who are following rules that they may or may not, you know, agree with or think they're in the best case for their patient. So with the ACGME, first of all, that's the American College of Graduate Medical Education, right? So this is a quote unquote private organization that sets the rules for the training of residents. And residents, after medical school, you go to residency most people go to residency where they get subspecialty training in some sort of, you know, like cardiology or in your case, pediatrics. And then you do a sub fellowship in allergy immunology. So the ACGME is a private organization, technically. It's not actually government run. How do they have so much power, and how do they get, I guess, how do they have implicit, I guess, authority through the federal government? I imagine is kind of where it comes from.
Yeah, I mean, the government is the only organization legally authorized to initiate force against innocent people. That's kind of the definition of government, right? So somehow, you know, all these universities are feeling compelled to abide by ACGME's benign, tyrannical dictums. But what is that compulsion? Mostly, I suspect it has to do with Medicare, because Medicare is the compulsory component. And in order to get that Medicare money, you've got to abide by whatever rules CMS comes up with. And I expect, but I don't know for sure, I expect that they've managed to wrangle a deal with ACGME to make sure that ACGME has an effective monopoly on the control of idiotic training ideas. And they certainly have done really well with coming up with idiotic training ideas. And then we're somehow, you know, either not fully compelled, but heavily manipulated into participating in those. And the bureaucrats don't realize it. The bureaucrats who run the universities just say, oh, we got to check that box, go do it. And they drop the bomb down on the dean, who drops it on the department heads to make sure their fellowship programs and residency programs all abide by a bunch of nonsensical escapees from the asylum who are filling the ACGME at this point.
Right. I mean, I guess you'd say that the ACGME is, I mean, probably if you're looking at the rules promulgation, it's probably the CMS says, in order for us to give special enhanced reimbursement to facilities that have training, you have to be ACGME approved, certified, right? And so the government can sort of make it compulsory, although it's not technically compulsory, that you have to abide by, ACGME's rules.
What you're talking about there a few minutes ago kind of connects, and the this notion of population medicine versus, you know, what we're supposed to be, which is taking care of our individual patients. I consider all that part of this collectivist infection, which is some kind of brain disease that's been increasingly taking over the population of the United States. And it seems to spread itself around wherever there's people checking. It's like an idea, an infectious idea that is really very, very harmful, which so I consider it a pathogen. And part of it in medicine, where we seem to be on the front lines of this collectivist takeover, is that the government, you know, way back in the 40s, World War II kind of time frame, put insurance companies as intermediaries in the healthcare system. We all know this story of how they did that to help, you know, companies recruit workers whenever all the other workers were over getting shot overseas. But if you think about what an insurance company is and has always been, it makes its profit from collective outcomes, not from individual outcomes. Right. You know, it does statistics and analysis. From the very first insurance company 400 years ago, it has done statistics and analysis, and the individual doesn't matter. And our government has stuck organizations in which culturally for four centuries have focused on collectivist outcomes as their entire focus and modus operandi, and stuck them in the middle of something that should be an entirely individualist thing, which is the relationship of a doctor with a patient and making the patient as well as you can be. We should be pure individualists with, you know, statistics and data providing advice to us and content to us and context to us. But this collectivist outcome thing, utter just horrible notion. And it all comes from, as almost always, a government stupid intervention.
Right. And I would say that most of the, and even when you look at these rules that you talk about and regulations, I mean, most of them are, I guess I would say, maybe most is not fair, but many of them are make sense, right? Like, for instance, not to have expired milk sitting in a refrigerator, right? And so we'll see this with Jayco, and I shouldn't call them Jayco because they have changed their name, which you may not be aware
of. No, I'm thankfully not aware.
they are no longer to be referred as Jayco, and maybe this is just where I am, but they're now just known as the Joint Commission, which of course is exactly the same thing. They used to Joint Commission accrediting hospital organization.
But no, now they get to accredit all kinds of different organizations. I expect that that's an expansion of their power, I guess.
I suspect that they are now, you're right, that they're probably working in the ambulatory field and maybe outside of medicine or at non-traditionally medical facilities, like, I don't know, maybe chiropractor's offices. I have no idea, but they're now known as simply the Joint Commission. And so what I'll see happen, and I'm sure this is not unique in any way to any hospital system, is that you will have them come through, and they can't come through your hospital and not find a violation or some sort of thing that needs to be corrected. I don't think they hardly ever shut a hospital down, but they'll find problems and they'll say, well, you know, it's kind of dangerous that you have these syringes sitting here, or you have, you know, the order's not done properly, your consent forms aren't dated adequate, whatever. And so these committees are then formed by the hospital to address the issue. And then the Joint Commission comes back a year later to make sure that you fix these. So they have this, I mean, obviously it's you have an institution as large as a hospital, especially if you're hospitals that now encompass outpatient facilities and clinics and things, you're going to find tons of things that are not done the way that they like. I mean, just by nature of any, if you walk, you know, just like walking through your house, you're going to find something wrong with your house. Because your house is big enough, you're going to find a crack in a wall or something. And so so they will just continue to find new things, which then of course means that they have to come back and, you know, perpetuates, but that they can't go through and not find anything, right? So they have to find something wrong. There has to be some sort of thing, initiative they're working on. And you'll see this in hospitals with these nursing commissions or committees are set up to, they just have to, they never remove rules or regulations. They always add them. And there is some element of, I guess, a rationality to the initial promulgation of the rules. Like, oh, this is a common sense thing to do. But of course, the thing is most people are doing things that make sense anyway, right? So like, you're not going to have rotten food in your refrigerator anyway. That's, you don't really need a regulation telling you to do things that everybody knows anyway. But just the nature that you're doing that is what it uses up a lot of extra time and resources, and it makes you fill out another form, right? so that now you're doing stuff that's not medicine. You have people who are doing non-medical things in your hospital. And when you see the explosion of administration numbers of people who are just doing non-clinical work in the hospitals, this is very much the reason why this occurs. And I'm sure in academia, I'm sure it's even doubly so, because you're also filling up boxes, not only just for the Joint Commission, but also for the residency and the training programs.
Yeah, it's I think totally out of control is what I'd say. When admin increases by tenfold while doctors increase by 50%, it's something is broken badly. And I think it's what can I say other than it's some kind of strange change in society that we sit there and allow these top-down command and control mentalities to tell us what to do. I don't mind them advising us what to do. I think that Jayco has a lot of really wise and smart suggestions in there.
Right.
And it's just the domineering demand command. It's like Obamacare. If you want to buy insurance, okay. And maybe a lot of people should have certain types of financial protection for their insurance, but to compel you to buy a certain type, it's so far outside the realm of anything that the federal government is supposed to be authorized to do. And yet the great majority of the country sat there and said, oh, okay. Yeah. And it's like, why did they accept that they have to do what they're told by a bunch of, semi-sociopathic people up there in Congress?
Yeah.
I don't get it.
So this has taken a really dark turn, this conversation. and I only say it because it's actually a really fun book. So that pokes fun at the rules. And so some of the things in there, I'm not even aware I'm wondering how many of them are real. And so that's why quick question. So one of the things in there was the rule prompt that ACGME instituted that was required sleep. Is that actually a rule? Because I know there are work hour requirements. Was there actually something about napping or resting or something like that? Or is that just your extension of sort of what the next step would be with work hour restrictions?
Now, when I wrote the book, that was the thing that I don't know if it ever got promulgated, but that was what the next, big move was going to be, was mandatory naps. That was serious. I don't know what happened to it. You'd know about it, I suspect, if it managed to not get scoffed at too much.
Right. But well, I haven't heard so. But again, I see all I do is see the residents in front of the computers, and so I had a whole episode about the electronic health records and sort of how clearly when you were there, it was even more paper based. It was funny that when the hospital moved to computer based record keeping, there was never more paper ever used than with that. And I
right
because of course, you couldn't actually find anything usually in the computer, so you had to have them print stuff out. And of course, you're printing out pages of information that was completely useless as far as what you want. I wanted just to see the echo report or maybe a couple lab values. I didn't need the entire H&P, which is 17 pages if you print it out. Just like if you print out a web page, it takes like 7 pages to print out a web page because you can scroll down, of course, right? So
right.
We've now thankfully gotten beyond that. And so now we actually do have less paper than we had in the past. But for many years there, it was humorous that there's far more paper. The paper chart that didn't exist that was actually necessary to get anything done because you didn't have the paper chart. And the things you wanted was not actually in the computer. But
yeah. My concern about EMRs, and probably I presented it in Assuming the Physician, is the doctor-EMR relationship as opposed to the doctor-patient relationship. And it's just a strange thing to see doctors staring at a computer screen or clicking off things on a computer or have their back turned to the patient. And it's the EMR. Yes, it has an ability to consolidate a bunch of data, most of which we don't need, but consolidate a bunch of stuff into an easily accessible way. But the purpose of the EMRs aren't, in general, to make patient care better. They're to make insurance billing more efficient and more comprehensive and to make sure that they sort their ICD-9 codes and their CPT codes in the right direction to get maximal billing. I mean, when you have a purpose, a primary purpose of that, as opposed to a primary purpose of optimizing patient care, you're bound to get into trouble. And I think that's the underlying reason why people still struggle with the EMRs and why patients are sitting there going, why aren't you looking at me, doctor?
Yeah, right. My wife has seen this in her practice, where now they can, everyone has EMRs now, and the EMRs, they have to make a decision when they design the EMR that you either design it to optimize billing or you optimize efficiency for flow through the clinic, make sure you have exactly the templates you want and make sure you have, make it simple to fill out what you need to make for your note for, what the patient's on, medication, those sorts of things. And so naturally everyone has to pick the billing portion so that it optimizes the billing, because if you don't make any money, then there's no point how great a clinical information it gathers because of course, then
you won't be there.
Right. And so, and what is, if you're not in medicine and it's hard to understand, what billing looks for is different than what a physician would look for. So, or in any sort of other business, well, let's say you're going to make sure you maximize the information necessary for that person to come back. For instance, I sell you a tire. I want to make sure that when you come back, I know what tire I put on and how much pressure was in it and, you know, which tire replaced. I don't care necessarily about 30 other things that, like, how often you come in for tires or what your race is, you know, what you're wearing, or, I mean, all kinds of other information, you know, whether you wear seatbelts. I mean, those things are not things that I'm concerned with, but for a third party who's paying for this, like with the insurance company, they have all kinds of other dictates that they're concerned about. And so, and they're going to make sure that when you come in that I ask you 27 different questions in order to maximize the amount I can charge for that tire. So this is probably a bad analogy, but I mean, basically, that's basically the problem, right? So that you have, you're gathering a bunch of information that is not clinically relevant and you're and storing it, which has no bearing on when you see this patient the next time. And so you're just getting there's a bunch of extra stuff there that you just don't need to, and it's waste time.
Yeah. It's just to get a category 4 code instead of a cat 3 code. Exactly. You know, it's all about that billing process, and it's relatively insane. And we know it all falls in. I mean, I think we know it. It all comes down to patients don't care about price. Doctors, I mean, they don't really think about price very much. And, right. And if anything, they don't mind getting paid a little more and upcoding some. And so you got two of the main agents involved in this, not caring or wanting a higher price. And then the real trick is that insurance companies want higher prices. And that's what I think people don't realize, is that the third party in the process, the insurance, they love higher prices because they don't pay them anyhow. They have negotiated rates and reference-based pricing sometimes, but they don't pay those prices. But the higher those prices are, the more they can claim that they're providing a worthwhile product to their patients by saving them 80% or whatever on the list prices. So we've got all three parties in the deal either not caring or wanting higher prices. And it's really quite insane. So no wonder prices rise.
Right. Well, and I think, you know, I discussed this last episode with Dr. Smith from Oklahoma. I mean, that was a part that I never quite got and never understood, is that you would think that insurance companies would obviously want prices to be lower, but they want them high as well, because there's, for just the reasons you just stated. And so that's what always was hard to understand, why healthcare would go up so much. You think, boy, these insurance companies should at least be putting a brake on this, but that's why they don't, and they have less incentive. So with back to the book, Dr. Marcus tries to go through his first year of residency. He's obviously a very bright guy. He's got all kinds of, he sees the craziness with the system, but I imagine in some ways he sort of mirrors a little bit of your life, just reading some of your bio. So in one part of the book, he goes to Liberia. You have set up a foundation for healthcare in Liberia. Can you go into that a little bit and sort of why and how you first got into that? I really don't know a whole lot about that at this point.
Sure. Yeah. Sometime in 2009, I was down in Costa Rica for a few weeks doing an academic project at a university down there at a children's hospital down in the capital city. Came back, spent one night in the U.S. and then popped to Liberia for my first trip over to West Africa. And what I found there was such a different world of health, not just medical care, but, you know, everything, of course, is so radically different as one would expect. But things like the patients would carry their own record with them, bring them into you. You could fill out a couple of lines, something important on it, and give them back the record. And they would be responsible enough to bring it back with them the next time, which basically resolves all the issues in an EMR right there. And quite simple. Of course, they had very little vaccination, and so you'd see all kinds of horrible diseases that we don't see in the U.S. But the general poverty there is so profound and interesting to see how they've recovered. The foundation is called the Trusted Angels Foundation, which the name is derived from doing angel investing in entrepreneurs in West Africa. So what we did was helped resuscitate a girls' boarding school, and then that we've moved on from now, and we pay for the college educations of those girls. Now we don't pay for college education in the United States, which is, in my view, kind of more of a 4-year indoctrination program. But we pay for the colleges in Liberia, West Africa, for the girls who are becoming women, and then nursing schools as well. And plus, we did clinics, and we branched off to another organization called Partners Liberia, which has developed a respiratory therapy school. This is not under my control, but it was a metastasis from ours, a happy metastasis, and they've ended up buying a hospital from that the Chinese had built a while back, and it's going to be the pulmonary hospital for Liberia. So it just kind of keeps on expanding on its own once it gets rolling.
Sure. And so when it comes to Liberia and the healthcare, it's clearly a lot different. Do you feel on some level that because it's so, primitive is not a fair word, but you know what I mean? As far as its development, it's far behind the United States and the Western world in many ways. I mean, they can kind of leapfrog by just getting new innovations right from the start. But do you feel like the regulation that naturally occurs and that the regulatory state is a natural occurrence as economies become more developed and become richer? So like, you know what I mean? Is that eventually at some point Liberia will have a JCO of sorts. I mean, do you think that's a natural extension of sort of democratic societies?
Yeah, I think it is. I think that as we give more power to government takes more power. And there's a reason for that, which is that there's kind of two different groups of people. One group likes to take control over nature or things and tries to manipulate things to work for them. You know, we build houses and cars. That's one group. And there's another group who like to manipulate people, have power over people. And it's the people who like to have power over people. The most extreme version of that is the sociopath. But people who like to have power over people are the ones who are attracted to government, because government is all about power over people. And so you get more and more and more of them, and then government gets bigger, and then you attract even more of them. And so there's this inevitable process in democracy that, or any kind of government, that leads to increasing centralized control. In the third world, it's often done differently. In the third world, it's competing sociopaths trying to do battle for control over the extant government. So civil war is a very common thing because they want that power structure. They want to control it so that they can, they can start stealing from the people just like the previous government did. And that's what happened in Liberia repeatedly. And you look to see who was running that place and who the fights were among, and for all those civil war years, and it's all just a bunch of really bad, evil people competing to be in charge of the government structure. In here in the United States, not terribly different. They're just not using bullets.
Right. I mean, you have a peaceful transition of power and governance, but it's so advanced that we have the same people running things, no matter who's technically in charge, right? It's the same people, the HHS or wherever that are setting forth the rules, and things don't change. As even at the top, the regulatory state doesn't really get much smaller.
Nope, I've never seen much get smaller. No, it just doesn't. There's a cycle of freedom, and we're on the downswing, I'm afraid. But then we have these positive things like direct primary care movement, tiny fraction. And I think you've talked to Chad Savage or somebody about that.
Yep, I've talked to a couple people. Mm-hmm.
It's so positive in so many ways. And the way I see deep direct primary care is that what it does, it takes this underlying problem in medical care, what was referred to as moral hazard, the lack of care about price, the third party payer problem, whatever you want to call it. It takes that moral hazard that causes the medical economy to hyperinflate so profoundly and brings it down to the level of the doctor and the patient, where if somebody is abusing the system, it's right there in the doctor's office. It's not, the insurance company doesn't have to say, oh, you're overusing the system, you're spending so much money. The doctor who the patient's doctor can say, you know what, you're abusing the system. You're spending too much money on things you don't need. And that's such an easier place to resolve it than the insurance company just, or a government just saying, no, you can't have a kidney transplant.
Right. Well, and I mean, you look at, and I planned to do an episode on this earlier, prior authorizations and things where you have, you basically turn the physician into, you know, trying, begging the insurance company to allow things to happen that they think is clinically relevant and important.
They're unpaid,
right?
I consider a physician who's doing that, which almost all do. I actually refuse to, and my nurse kind of took all that, but effectively same thing.
You're paying her to do it, right? Yeah.
Yeah. But yes, it's just that the physician becomes an unpaid member of the insurance company's cost containment policy.
Yeah.
And, you know, what on earth? Why on earth? You know, I got bawled out by somebody who was higher in the ranks than me at EVA at one point because I'd sent a letter to the insurance company billing them for my services. And he said, if I could fire you, I'd fire you. I said, oh, too bad you can't, man.
It's been nice to have tenure.
I wasn't even tenured yet. But, just knew he couldn't. But yeah, later got tenure. But then I resigned it within like 2 years or 3 years of getting it. So it wasn't very valuable.
So in the end of the book, I don't want to spoil the ending for those who are going to get the book, again, called Assume the Physician. And the link for that obviously will be in the show notes page at paradox.com/013. Dr. Marcus decides to leave medicine, right? And he goes into his explanation of things, but he doesn't really totally, I guess, in some ways. But do you think today, if you rewrote that book, he would become a direct primary care physician and you'd have that emphasized in your book?
Yeah, I think there's some things I would have changed. Yeah, sure. DPC would have been his route as opposed to the kind of the route that you'll see happens in the book. I would have put in information about pharmacy benefit managers when I'm talking about the drugs. I wasn't aware of the degree to which they have tortured us all with that hugely crony catastrophe that is the pharmacy benefit managers. I would have put that in there. You know, I was able to elucidate, hopefully with some gut cracking humor, the way that the pharmaceutical reps, you know, tried to get talking heads or what they call thought leaders to spew out the stuff for the pharmaceutical companies, not to try to get doctors to prescribe more drug, but to be able to convince the speaker increasingly of the value of their drug. So their speaker, when they go sit on a committee that ends up writing some kind of protocol or best practices document, ends up promoting their particular drug. And I think that's the trick that most doctors don't know, is that it's the thought leaders. They're selected not because of their incredible skill at getting other doctors to write prescriptions, but on their likelihood of being promoted up to some position of authority in a guidelines writing committee. And right. All the rest is just, what's that?
I was going to say, that was really interesting. And I had never thought of that before, but it makes a lot of sense. I mean, maybe I'm naive in that I don't really think of, or at least I'm certainly not that sophisticated to think that far in advance, but I'm sure these pharmaceutical companies have, and that you're finding people who are going to write on it, sit on a commission for, say, the cardiologist, and they're going to have in their algorithm, you're going to take this drug at this point if this drug fails. And, you know, most physicians abide by those because they're guidelines. They're usually based in some sort of evidence, but you'd rather have your beta blocker there than someone else's beta blocker, the first one there or whatever. And so that was a very interesting insight. I had not thought of it. The only thing I had noticed is that all the drug reps look pretty much the same. When I was at Iowa as a resident, they all seem to be former football players who are selling devices. All the orthopedic device salesmen were former football players of the football team.
Right.
And so I think the orthopedic guys love the athletes coming in, the ones they oftentimes treated before.
Yeah. You know, whatever works. That the marketing people, their job is to market, and they find great ways to do it.
Right.
I don't object. The problem is it sits on top of a situation where there's no price signals of any kind because of the intermediacy of the insurance companies and the government. And so it leaves the system to hyperinflate. So it's all part of a big, horrible system that the government absolutely instigated. It created this disaster. And then Obamacare just ended up mandating what we all participate in, crony central.
Right. And you know, Dr. Smith does not feel this way, and he says too magnanimous for things, but I think a lot of it is sort of unintentionally sort of you end up where you are, and it's not intentional that people expect to cause, say, drug shortages by having the pharmacy benefit managers and the group purchasing organizations in place. It was definitely signed and passed in order to create a monopolized system, in which case they profited heavily from the sort of crony capitalist sense. But they never anticipated that it would cause these drug shortages that I have to deal with, and that patients have to deal with, where they don't have access to the medications they need.
It's amazing that things like normal saline or PBS or sodium bicarb are not available sometimes. You know, what on earth? I mean, what took it to the point where there's only a couple of manufacturers who can make sodium bicarbonate infusion drips? I mean, that's something I could do in my lab in about 45 seconds, run it through a bacteriologic filter, do a couple of tests, and make sure it's good. Yep. No reason a pharmacy can't do that in the basement of the hospital. But where somehow it's got the system is now so screwed up and so fearful that you can't make a bag of normal saline in your own hospital.
You can have a fifth grader make that, right? You tell much sodium chloride to put it back.
Yeah, just to sterilize it up real quick. I mean, that's not hard to do. You squeeze it through a filter, and you obviously use good sourced ingredients, but making up bags of fluid, why do we have to rely on some manufacturing facility in Puerto Rico or wherever it is?
Well, and ultimately what's complicated about it is, of course, these rules were set forth in 1987 or whatever. That's when the safe harbor law was passed. And so it takes a long time before you get a market that becomes so fragile that a natural disaster or you know, a fire in a plant or something is what suddenly shuts down. And now you have no flexibility in the market. Like, there aren't many products in the United States, especially such an advanced economy, where you know there's no backup if something happens. If there's a fire in a toothpaste factory, there'll be plenty of toothpaste still on the shelves. I use this analogy all the time. So to find out more about your stuff, where would you recommend people go and your other books?
Well, I guess to get Assume the Physician, the easiest way, of course, is to go to Amazon. Probably the primary way. There's a small book publishing house, which we've created, called High Ground Books, which is highgroundbooks.com. And that promotes primarily the novels that I'm writing with my co-author, Doug Casey. First one is called Speculator. The next one in the series is called Drug Lord. Third one will be coming out pretty soon, called Assassin. Those books are novels. They're action thrillers, but they're all about ends not justifying means. It's about libertarian mentality and what would a hero be like who doesn't initiate force against the innocent, and how can that hero mature over the course of his lifetime? Those are fun books, and they get good attention. And we're hoping to get more attention. Ron Paul wrote a cover blurb for us, and a lot of other notables. So they can go to High Ground Books. And also, as of tomorrow, between today and tomorrow, I'll be managing the business side of a newsletter called International Man, which has been around for a while. It's Doug Casey's International Man. He wrote a book in 1978-79 that was a big hit about how to internationalize assets, get out from underneath the bureaucracy of the government of the United States, help to avoid jurisdictional malfeasance on your own. And so International Man, we'll be talking a lot on International Man going forward about the healthcare system in the U.S. and the rest of the world, and how to find free market solutions, how to get, go to Caymans to get your surgery at a 20% of the price, and medical tourism in general, all kinds of things like that will be on internationalman.com.
Great. And readjohnhunt.com too. I saw as a site for at least a way to find you. Assume the Physician and your other book too.
Correct. I don't actually go to those sites very much myself anymore. I need to take a look at those.
My friend has the same problem, as she has so many different websites. She kind of forgets them. And so I'm like, don't you have this site? Oh yeah, I have that one too.
Right.
It's a wonder of the internet that you can, you know, pay $10 as a recurring fee. You really don't notice the $10 that comes out of your bank account every once a year, and you just own those sites in perpetuity. And if you don't adjust them, and you know, they just kind of sit there. They're always open. I suppose there'll be a lot of people who'll be running websites until a year after they expire. Then suddenly,
right, and then they're gone.
The credit card no longer works. That person's dead, and so now we'll close, turn down your site. But they'll be going long after you're dead for a while anyway.
Yeah.
So I have a quick question on the medical tourism. So is that something that, well, you're no longer practicing, but if you're getting knee replacement or something like that, is that something you recommend to people that they go to?
Oh my, yeah.
So who's operating the Cayman Islands? Cause you know, I'm not going to tell someone to go to India for surgery. I mean, I'm sure you can get stuff done there, but how do you navigate that? Is that, you know, how do you figure all that stuff out?
Well, the first thing is that the insurance companies aren't really supporting it yet. So you're really that the people who are going to do this, the people who've got to spend their own money, the sharing ministry members, uninsured, or people who just insist on not participating in this crony system in the United States. But there's medical tourism companies. MedRetreat is one of them. MediBid, and you should talk to both of these people. MedRetreat is Judd Anglin. Anglin, and MediBid is Ralph Weber. MediBid is an online auction system, and they go international. MediBid will get prices in from people like Keith Smith at Oklahoma Surgical Center, and you can go online and get doctors bidding for the lowest price, highest quality combination for your services. And that same thing is expanding around the world. So you can go to Caymans and have this wonderful trip in the Caymans, get your knee replaced for 20% or whatever the cost of the United States by absolutely tip-top places in a tippy-top hospital with highly trained physicians. Same in Thailand. You get much better care, much better accommodations, and much better care. Fully good U.S. Type of care in these places for a fifth of the cost, and your family can get a vacation out of it too. But it's only for the free market people. It's not for the people who are stuck in the crony insurance system.
Right. Well, very interesting. I'll have to add that to my list. I was telling people when I started this podcast, I said, well, after about four episodes, I don't really know what I'm going to talk about, but it turns out there's a lot to talk about. And the stack, stack is pretty hot, pretty big.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'd love it if you could do one on evidence-based medicine and what that really means. You know, we could talk about that for a long time too.
Right. And I think, I've heard, let's see, Russ Roberts? An econ talk or someone did one on that. And anyway, it was very interesting, but I think it would be nice to kind of go over that because when I talked to Dr. Akkad, it was sort of that when you talked about patient treating populations, not patients, it's sort of along those same lines. Mm-hmm. But it is complicated in the sense that, you know, as a physician, there's an expectation that you use the large patient population studies to drive your care, right? So, you know, well, this medication usually works, so it'd be wise for me to use this on this patient. But, you know, where that fine line is of treating the person versus now you're just treating, I think everyone should be on this because that's a good idea, and not individualizing your treatment, but still using the population-based studies to guide your therapy on some level too. It becomes a little tricky, you know, when you're trying to figure out the percentages of likelihood of things working or not. And it, especially when I came of age in medical school where, of course, evidence-based medicine was the gold standard of medicine. And I'm sure you're pretty much the same time as I was.
And yeah, so, I kind of barfed on the gold standard a lot, but yeah, I was certainly taught that.
It's nice that someone believes in a gold standard, right? I think that's someone encouraging. If only a name, right?
Yeah, yeah. In China, So I review and edit Chinese papers, just medical papers of Chinese scientists who want to publish in the English language literature. And I just do that to keep my fingers in the game and to be knowledgeable about what's coming out, at least out of China. But one thing I found, about 95% of the writers of these articles have collectivism so much built into their brain that they make conclusions that I would think are insane. Like they'll find, for example, some drug that they're comparing two drugs, and one of them works in 52% of people and the other one works better in 48% of people. And their conclusion that they're going to recommend to, you know, the entire government of their nation or their province is that only the one that works in 52% of the patients is the one that should be used. I mean, it's that degree of collectivist, you know, infection, brain disability that has come out of that, you know, thousands of years of collectivist mentality.
That's sort of like if you win 56% of the vote that you have a mandate to do something, right?
Right. Yeah, it's the same kind of thing. It's, you know, it's, we do have an illness. I think the nation has a collective illness of collectivism, and it's so pathological. You know, when it's reared its head, it, you know, it caused, you know, Pol Pot exterminating a quarter of his population, Mao Zedong killing 50 million, you know, Stalin 30 million, Hitler 10 million. When you have these kind of collectivist, these paths forward of collectivism, huge numbers of people die from that illness. And then where it's less severe, like in Cuba or in Venezuela, you get just massive loss of dignity, a little bit less loss of life, but a huge amount of loss of dignity from this collectivist infection. And it's taken off. We had a democratic socialist elected or nominated in New York recently to run for Congress. It's like, what? I mean, I know they want change, but do they want change that way? To change to more government control, more narcissists running the damn asylum? I don't know.
Right. Well, on that cheery note,
I'm sorry, I'm supposed to be cracking jokes, right?
Yeah, I thought so. No, I'd like to, again, I'd like to recommend the book, Assume the Physician, really funny. And I imagine, I don't know Joseph Heller, who wrote Catch-22, but I imagine pretty much that sort of, you know, when you have sort of a cynic, a bemused cynicism that you look at the world, and I was just listening to a talk about Stoicism, it's sort of along the same lines it's almost like a gallows humor, right? In some way. And so that's why I think the book, you'll learn a lot and while you're also being entertained. And so I'd highly recommend, again, it'll be available on the show notes page at paradox.com/13. Dr. Hunt, thank you so much for spending this morning with me and my listeners.
Thank you so much for having me. I'll crack more jokes next time.
Perfect.
All right.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening to The Paradox. If you like what the doc is doing, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes or Stitcher. And share the show with your friends. Become a supporting listener to get access to special bonuses at patreon.com/theparadox. Show notes can be found at theparadox.com.
Excuse me. Well, you shouldn't do an interview first thing in the morning, I guess.
I can take over while you're recovering. Yeah. Sorry about that.
No, it's all me.
go ahead.